Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 26th of June, 2012, and today I'm talking on the line to Eric Dreitzer of StopImperialism.com, a previous guest on this podcast and someone whose podcast I would recommend everyone out there to check out, as well as the informative articles he's writing on a regular basis for Stop Imperialism. So, Eric Dreitzer, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me, James.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Russia. And as I'm sure many of the listeners and viewers out there will know, last month, Vladimir Putin came back to power as president for another term in Russia, and people are still trying to figure out what his place in the geopolitical game is and whether or not he's going to have a similar presidency to his first go-around 4 years ago. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Putin's re-rise to power, if he ever really lost it, and what this might mean on the geopolitical stage?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good way of starting out to say that whether or not Putin ever actually left power is sort of a question. Many saw Medvedev as Putin's puppet, though I think that that's a little bit simplistic. Medvedev and Putin, certainly Medvedev is a protege of Putin, but Medvedev comes from a slightly different background. His background was through Gazprom, through the state oil and gas community, I suppose you could say, whereas Putin comes directly out of the KGB intelligence network. So that in and of itself distinguished a difference between them. However, I think it would be fair to say that Medvedev took a lot of advice and or diktats from Putin. But regardless of that, Putin's return to the presidency is quite significant. First of all, it's important to remember that this protest movement, so-called protest movement, which surrounded Putin's return to power, much of this was essentially a feeble attempt by Western powers at destabilizing Putin, return to the regime's return, I suppose we could say, the National Endowment for Democracy, various other U.S. institutions which were funding the various groups opposed to Putin. So even at the outset, we could already see how important it was to the Western imperialist establishment to try to prevent Putin, or at least to weaken him as he returned to power. And exactly as you mentioned, the reason for this is really geopolitical in significance. Putin, in terms of his national policies, is, I think, less interesting to the Western powers. But what Putin represents to them is a block to their interests everywhere from Syria to South Asia to the Pacific Ocean. Putin is, unlike Medvedev and unlike most other leaders in the world, Putin is not intimidated. And in fact, Putin, I suppose we could say, takes some pleasure in being obstinate, in being a countervailing force on the geopolitical scene. If you saw the recent pictures from the G20 when Putin and Obama met, it was quite clear what Putin was trying to put out there in terms of his image. Obama was smiling and jovial and warm, and Putin was cold and distant and restrained. And this is not by accident. Putin is master at putting out a message without having to say many words about it. So his return represents a pulling away from the United States, pulling away from Western Europe in terms of the cordiality that they enjoyed and the subservience that they enjoyed under Medvedev. For example, I think Libya is one of the great examples of the difference between a Medvedev-led Russia and a Putin-led Russia. In my judgment, and this is certainly my opinion, in my judgment, we would not have seen Russia quite so quick to be subservient to Western interests with regard to Libya had Putin been the president at the time. And I think the best example of the difference between Putin and Medvedev is what we're seeing in terms of Syria. It seems that Russia has drawn the line behind Putin as president, saying that there will be no military intervention in Syria precisely for the reasons that I outlined, because Putin recognizes that his interests are 180 degrees diametrically opposed to the U.S. interest in Syria, and he will not, under any circumstances, bow to U.S. pressure with regard to giving up on Syria.
Well, many important points to pick up from there. So let's tackle the issue that you brought up of the spontaneous protest movement, or the way that it's being portrayed. Of course, this is what the media is trying to frame pretty much every story about Putin and Russia these days to basically highlight, is the protests that have taken place in Moscow and other places supposedly against Putin's reign. Well, for example, last week, Reuters came out with a story quoting the first Deputy Prime Minister Igor Shuvalov, Kirilov, who said that protest in Russia is now the new norm, and that they're going to have to adjust to this this idea of opposition making itself heard and felt on the streets of Moscow and St. Petersburg, etc. To what extent do you think that this protest movement really exists in the way that it's being portrayed in the Western media, or is it something that's being hyped up in the media? Is it something that's spontaneous? Is it something that's being puppeteered or incited from outside? And are there elements that might be sympathetic to the aims of the protesters within Putin's own government?
Well, that's a I think, a multifaceted question there. I think that it certainly is true that there is a protest. I wouldn't even necessarily call it a movement, but there are sympathies that exist in Russia. And certainly many of them do come out of legitimate grievances. However, what I pointed out to anybody who asks me about this topic is there is no coherent program for the protesters. They have no specific demands, nothing economic, nothing even really political beyond these vague notions of what they call transparency or anti-corruption or, you know, whatever the watchword or the buzzword of that week might be. And this is something that falls in line with what we've seen over the course of the last 10 to 15 years of the color revolutions, right? That the color revolutions, the uniting principle is never an economic demand. The uniting principle is always crusading against some perceived evil that exists within the country, whether it was the Yanukovych government in the Ukraine, whether it was the government in Iran in 2009, or in the form of Putin today. So the protest movement is minimal, I would say, because it has no real groundswell of support among regular Russian people. You ask somebody in rural Russia what they think of a bunch of 20-something protesters on the streets in Moscow, they're going to say, I have nothing in common with them. So what we see then is that the forces that have been fomenting this this movement, they really emanate directly out of the United States. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. Michael McFaul, the U.S. Ambassador to Russia. This is one of his specialties, what he calls, I believe the term was anti-tyranny or anti-dictator or something to that effect. That's his specialty. In other words, fomenting color-style destabilizations, color revolutions. And we saw even recently the video that came out on YouTube, I guess it was from about January or so, you literally saw the leaders of the opposition movement marching into the U.S. Embassy to take their marching orders from McFaul. So it's one of those rare examples where you could clearly state this is who is organizing it, this is who is responsible for fomenting it, and Putin himself said it publicly. So there really is no secret about it in Russia. It's only in the United States where they want to veil this whole thing under the veneer of some kind of an organic movement. There's nothing organic about it. Leaders such as Navalny, I mean, what is Navalny's background? Navalny is a blogger, a Yale-educated financier or financial speculator turned blogger in Russia. Do you think he has anything in common with Russian people? Certainly not. So again, the movement itself is minimal. I think what's more important, though, is it shows how dangerous Putin is perceived to be by the ruling establishment in the West, that they would go to such degree to try to destabilize him. And I think it's also indicative of how powerful and how popular he is in Russia that this movement went nowhere.
Well, I think you're exactly right to say that the Western interests are definitely aligned against Putin, because he does seem to be that sort of block on their geopolitical chessboard, the piece that's not letting them take the parts of the board that they want. So let's examine what Putin is actually aiming for. He's talked, for example, in the past about creating a Eurasian Union, and certainly he has gone to some length to further ties between Russia and China, for example, in the formation of a new power bloc that might form some sort of counterbalance to NATO. What do you think we're likely to see in the coming years as Putin positively asserts his place on the geopolitical board?
Well, it precisely as you mentioned, the move towards the warming of relations, and we shouldn't even really say warming at this point, close relations, very close formal relations with China. This is the key. It's not just the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which is something that we've seen developing over the course of the last 10 years. And this is Putin's baby, really. I mean, Putin is the reason why the SCO exists. But the BRICS, and in particular, the revelation this past BRICS summit of a BRICS development bank. This is one of the huge projects, I think, that we're going to see over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. If the BRICS can emerge as a viable alternative to a dollar-dominated world economy, with a move away from the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency and conducting their transactions in some other form, whether that's some kind of a basket of currencies or whatever, that would be probably the great fruits of Putin's return to power, because it would break dollar hegemony and it would prevent what we've seen for the last 20 years, a unipolar world where the United States gets to essentially go around the world dominating it in whatever way it sees fit. And this is, of course, anathema to what Wall Street and the U.S. Ruling class wants. And so, again, this is one of the reasons why they're so terrified of Putin. But I think it goes even further than that, because Putin is able to resist the rhetoric. Putin, it does not fall for whatever the games are. So take one example of Syria. Putin sees all of this pressure coming towards him, right? This pressure from Obama, pressure from Clinton and Cameron and even Hollande and Merkel and all of the rest of them at the G20. And what does he do? He turns around and says, well, what do you got for me on the anti-ballistic missiles? What have you got for me on the various other issues that he has with the United States? So he's ready to play the game of geopolitics. And this is something that the ruling establishment does not want, because their bargaining position is very, very weak, while the Russians are quite strong. It is true that Russia has very severe problems internally, economic problems. They're a very one-dimensional economy, very petrodollar-based, which prevents them from developing in the way that they need to. But that being said, Putin represents the return of a strong and powerful Russia. And as you mentioned, the Eurasian Union, the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, what is the one thing that ties them all together? Putin.
Well, I broadly agree with your assessment, and it's one that I've made myself on the work that I do. But there are some pieces of the puzzle that might run counter to that. So let's take a look at, for example, Putin's recent visit to Israel, where they were obviously discussing such things as Syria and the ongoing crisis there. And there was an interesting article that came out on Haaretz that noted an interesting part of the meeting there between some of Putin's top officials and some of Israel's top officials. And the article reads in part, quote, following Lieberman was Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov wearing a sour face. That's no surprise either. Putin chose to make Israel his first stop on his Middle East visit over Lavrov's vehement objections. Filthy Arabist, mumbled a member of the Russian-Israeli press when Lavrov entered. Well, I think we understand the Israeli objections to people like Lavrov and the outspoken nature with which he's counteracted a lot of the propaganda on Syria, but it is interesting that there would be any type of disagreement there between Lavrov and Putin, and Putin insisting on making Israel his first stop in his Middle East visit. What do you make of that?
I think that there's probably a couple of different explanations for that. I think that there's certainly a good cop, bad cop dynamic that's being played there. This is something that Putin and Medvedev played to no end in their time as prime minister and president. So I think that that's an element. And one of the other reasons why is because the Russians, their interests in Syria, it's not just an interest of allegiances. I mean, in the game of geopolitics, it's far beyond allegiances. It's about strategic interests. The Russians have a very real strategic interest in Syria. At the same time, the Russians also have a very real strategic interest with places like Israel or even just the Western powers. So they certainly do not want to be perceived as shunning Israel in order to, say, be the protector of Assad and the protector of Syria. So I hesitate. I understand the position, but I hesitate to read too much into, you know, him making Israel as his first stop, because while that's happening, at the same time, they're continuing to make public statements in support of Syria, continuing to make the public statements in support of national sovereignty against U.S. domination. So, again, I mean, I hesitate to read too much into that.
Well, let's turn to Syria, because obviously it is the current nexus and focal point of Western and Russian attention at the moment in geopolitics. So let's talk a little bit about Syria and some of the back and forth that's been going on between the various power blocks, basically squabbling over that country as if they have any right to have any say over it. But let's take a look, for example, at the recent revelation of the Hula massacre, which, of course, once it was broken as a story, it was 24/7 played on pretty much every mainstream news news channel in the West as an example of the atrocities committed by the Assad government. When in the preceding weeks, as more facts continued to emerge about Hula, they started to complicate the idea that this had anything to do with the Free Syrian Army. Let's talk a little bit about what happened at Hula and how it was reported originally.
Well, the original story as it came out within the first 36 hours was that the Hula massacre was instigated by the Assad forces because of a shelling. Right. That was what they wanted people to believe initially, that they had been shelling the civilian population because, according to the Western propaganda, Assad, as I mentioned in my recent article, they want you to believe that Assad is a monster, that he's the devil incarnate, that he's just wantonly bombing innocent civilians. And that was what they wanted the Hula massacre to be. However, it became clear relatively quickly that this was not a tenable position, because the pictures, the photographs alone showed that, in fact, these were people who were massacred at close range. They were not the victims of shelling. They were the victim either of summary execution, gunshot wounds at close range, or possibly knife wound stabbings, or whatever else, whatever other atrocities we might want to say happened at Hula. The other information that came out was that a lot of this was staged, that many of these people were killed elsewhere. Their bodies were brought to the massacre site, and this was sort of like a photo opportunity, right? So we saw that the entire narrative that had originally been built up immediately shifted within 36 hours when the photographs came out. And then it shifted again when the eyewitness versions came out. The eyewitness is saying that these death squads had come in and had instigated this massacre and had perpetrated these atrocities, that it was not the military forces. And what happened was, and this was what I found most interesting, was that somehow the Western media forgot to ask the most basic question of all, and that is, if the Assad military forces had committed this atrocity, what interest of theirs did it serve? The answer is none. It was absolutely not in the interests of the Assad military forces or the Assad government to have this type of an incident. It was in the interests of those who want to see a military intervention. The Free Syrian Army, the various other death squads fighting under a variety of other banners, and I think broadly we could say the various al-Qaeda forces which have been brought into Syria to destabilize it. So I think that the conclusions that I drew from the Hula massacre were, well, the following. Most importantly, it showed the way in which the media is attempting to be almost like another arm of the military of the Western powers. That is to say, creating the necessary pretext for an intervention. And the Hula massacre is just one example of this. I mean, we've had an endless series of these types of provocations, coming all the way up to this week with the downing of this Turkish jet over Syrian airspace. The idea being to use any event that they possibly can to drum up support for a military intervention. And what is, I think, fascinating for listeners to sort of think about is, think how hard it is for them to get a military intervention to go on in Syria when it was so easy for them in Libya. And then think back to the question of Putin. And then it becomes clear why Putin is so important on the world stage. Without Putin and the power of Putin's government behind Syria, I think it's quite obvious that we would have already had a war in Syria, a military intervention. So it's not to say that I speak because, you know, in support of Putin, rather to show his significance on the world stage. Syria is the best example of that.
Well, I think you are right to situate what's going on in terms of the Hula massacre in a broader context of repeated attempts to convince the public that that Assad is some sort of suicidal monster who will do absolutely anything for, even if it serves no, it goes against his own interests. It's rather a bizarre story that they expect us to believe, and unfortunately, they continue to roll out pieces of evidence that directly contradict what they originally reported. And as you mentioned, the latest example of this is the downing of a Turkish jet in Syrian airspace. So let's talk about this story, how it developed, and what we've learned so far.
So last week, the news was reported that a Turkish jet had gone missing. And initially, a Turkish jet going missing, I mean, this could be any number of things. It could have, you know, dropped off the radar, could have been a mechanical malfunction, whatever. Then it became clear that it was actually shot down, and that it was shot down by Syrian military forces. Now, this was immediately sort of, a red flag to most people, saying this might be the incident that they're looking for. And I would, before I even continue with this, I would just put in people people's minds that there's a long and storied history of these types of provocations, whether you want to talk about the Gulf of Tonkin incident, whether you want to talk about the Gliwice massacre that led to the Germans invading Poland. I mean, there's any number of examples of precisely this type of incident leading to a military intervention in some form or another. So anyway, with the narrative of this, by Friday, it was clear that the Syrians had shot it down. This immediately led to worldwide outrage from Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice to Erdogan in Turkey to, you know, the Arab League and all of these other forces, essentially once again saying that Assad is a monster, that he's a butcher, and that they're, you know, essentially trying to create a war with Turkey. The reality is, and this was now documented in mainstream media, the Miami Herald, the Associated Press, a variety of other sources, that no, in fact, the Turkish jet had been in Syrian airspace, that it had violated international law by entering Syrian airspace, and therefore, according to international law, which, despite what the United States might want you to believe, is still presumably the law that we're supposed to be following, according to international law, Syria is within its rights to shoot down the plane. Now, the Syrian government has recently come out and said that it was an accident. But what they're really – in other words, that they're anti aircraft systems had shot it down automatically, that they didn't intend to necessarily shoot down the jet. This could be true. This could be false. It's sort of irrelevant, I think, for our purposes. What matters is it demonstrates that Syria is not Libya. Syria is not Serbia. Syria is none of these things. Syria is going to cost you lives. It's going to cost you planes. It's going to cost you a whole lot of resources if you push forward with a war. This was a signal to the Western powers and to Turkey especially that you don't want to get into a war with Syria because Syria's got real defenses. And so I think that from a propaganda perspective on the Western side, they want to show that the Syrians are warmongers, that the Syrians are inviting a war. The Syrians are trying to show conversely that they're ready to fight off any attack against them. And so this is sort of a ratcheting up of the pressure. However, I think it's quite interesting because when the news came out, I guess it was about 48 hours ago now, that this had been actually over Syrian airspace, this was quite clear to everyone. And then the Turks had to pull back and say, well, no, actually, this was in international airspace. And they know why, because it became obvious to everybody that the Turks were the ones in violation of international law.
Well, as people watch these events playing out in faraway countries, in distant lands for most people out there that are watching this, and who it seems that a lot of people feel absolutely powerless as they watch these events unfold and the big players on the chessboard move their pieces around, what is it positively that people out there who are watching or listening to this can do to actually affect this discourse and to hopefully do something to prevent the type of cataclysm and really wholesale murder that we saw going on in Libya? What can people do to prevent that happening in Syria?
Well, I think that there's a number of things. From the propaganda perspective, I think that we have to work in whatever capacity we can to educate others and at the same time to discredit the mainstream media. The mainstream media cannot function if it's totally discredited. They have to have some kind of veneer of factual, I don't even know what you would call it, authenticity. And without that, the mainstream media loses its luster. And when it loses its readership and listenership, as it's doing, it becomes less and less of an issue. CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, all of these propagandists, all of their ratings are going down. The alternative media is on the rise. And within the alternative media is a new battleground. Because what we see is that within the alternative media, you have the establishment alternative media, which would be something like a Democracy Now! Foundation funded that toes the I guess we could call it the imperialist line on certain issues. Syria, Libya are good examples of that. So there's a rhetorical and an information propaganda war that we need to be fighting. At the same time, there needs to be political mobilization. We need to be prepared to organize ourselves into political resistance to, here in the United States, it would be resistance to Obama and resistance to Romney. Rejection of both sides of the ruling class, or in Occupy Wall Street parlance, rejection of the 1%. To mobilize against the 1%, the imperialist ruling class that is perpetrating these crimes, is to take away their power. They cannot continue to wage wars, endless wars overseas, if their power erodes roots here at home. And so it needs to go beyond Occupy, beyond the Tea Party, beyond all of these factional movements, and to create a broad base of resistance to precisely these types of forces. I would call it resistance to finance capital, resistance to Wall Street, which is what bankrolls all of these institutions which are pushing the war. If you want to take on institutions as large as the mainstream media and the foundations and the NGOs and all of these seemingly monolithic entities, you can't do that in individual battles. You have to do it on a comprehensive level, and that involves creation of coalitions to stand up to the power of finance capital, which seeks to dominate us and to dominate the rest of the world.
Right, lots of stimulating things for people to mull on, and certainly I hope they will do that at your website. Why don't you direct people to your website again, and we'll direct people there for more information on these subjects.
Great. The website is stopimperialism.com. At stopimperialism.com, you can listen to my weekly podcast. I also publish articles on the website. Also, I do an interview series. I hope people will check it out there as well. Recent interviews include Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report, Atif K. Butt, Pakistani journalist, Mark Carlin of truthout.org, a variety of other people. So it's a pretty eclectic mixture. And putting out the podcast every week, you can also see my stuff on boilingfrogspost.com, Sybil Edmonds website, and a variety of other places. So, yeah.
All right, Eric Dreitzer, fascinating conversation as always. So thank you for your time today.
Thanks so much, James.